There are no gods. There are no gods, and you can please yourself. Have a game of tennis. Go out in the car. Do some shopping. Sit and talk. Talk with a cigarette browning your fingers. There are no gods, and you can please yourself. Go and please yourself. But leave me alone. Leave me alone to myself. And then in the room, whose is the presence that makes the air so still and lovely to me? Who is it that softly touches the sides of my breast and touches me over the heart so that my heart beats, soothed and at peace? Who is it smooths the bed sheets like the cool, smooth ocean when the fishes rest on edge in their own dream? Who is it that clasps and kneads my naked feet till they unfold, till all is well, till all is utterly well, the lotus lilies of the feet? I tell you, it is no woman, it is no man, for I am alone, and I fall asleep with the gods that are not, or that are according to the soul's desire, like a pool into which we plunge, or do not plunge.
There are no gods. And yet, whose is that presence that touches me over the heart? Last Sunday, we spoke of disasters and catastrophes of all sorts, from those occurring in the natural world to the worst manifestations of human greed, cruelty, and violence. And we considered two works by Tennyson as examples of our human responses amidst unspeakable trauma. Little did I anticipate when I scheduled last Sunday's topic that our nation was on a collision course and that the reverberations of shock would be unprecedented. Today we speak of reverence, humility, bringing healing to our broken nation. Again, in planning today's topic long ago, little did I anticipate the degree to which reverence and respect for life would be required of us in the aftermath of the elections. A collision which has left our nation and much of the world stunned in disbelief and facing an uncertain road ahead. So what's all this about reverence and humility in these times? Once upon a time, long ago, there lived in England an autocratic and tyrannical king, together with his three daughters. The king was far advanced in years. The time of his death was approaching. The elderly king began preparing to divide up his powers and his kingdoms and designate a portion to each of his three daughters as their inheritance. Sensing that the end was near, the king summoned his three daughters to appear before him. Before deciding how he would divide up his wealth, the king instructed each of his daughters to declare and demonstrate the extent of their love for him. "Tell me, my daughters," the king says, "which of you shall we say doth love us most?" The eldest daughter, Goneril, speaks first. "Sir, I love you more than word can wield the matter, dearer than eyesight, space, and liberty, beyond what can be valued, rich or rare, a love that makes breath poor and speech unable," on and on, blah, blah, blah. When Goneril finishes her profession of her love for her father, he is very pleased. He points to a map of his kingdom and indicates a most desirable chunk of real estate which he will give to Goneril. "Land with plenteous rivers and shadowy forests and wide-skirted meads. It is zoned for unlimited development of shopping malls, high-rise hotels, casinos, and golf resorts. It is a real bonanza for Goneril. In return for her having put on display for Daddy her flowery language of love. The king turns next to daughter number two, Reagan, and presents the same challenge to her. Reagan, who by now has figured out what hoops she must jump through to get her share of the inheritance, also complies with gushy praise to the old king. And she too gets a lavish reward. Finally, the old king turns to his most beloved, his youngest daughter, Cordelia. Now, our joy, although our last and least, what can you say? To draw a third more opulent than your sisters, speak. Cordelia replies, nothing, my lord. Lear. Nothing? Cordelia. Nothing? Lear. Nothing will come of nothing. Speak. Speak again. Cordelia. Unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. King Lear pleads once more, saying to her, How, Cordelia, mend your speech a little, lest you may mar your fortunes. Cordelia remains silent. Lear is outraged. He strips her of her inheritance and divides his kingdom between his other two daughters. Cordelia's dilemma is yours and mine, especially in the aftermath of this week's election and amidst the bewilderment, the fear, the scrambles to gain a piece of the action, to figure out how to perhaps come up on top or at least to rearrange it a little bit, as if what is unfolding is yet another reality show, a kind of survival. How's that for another oxymoron? Reality. Good. Cordelia's dilemma is this: how shall I live authentically amidst voices which are demanding, prove yourself, show me results, demonstrate that you love me, that you're serious, that you're useful, that you're making a difference. I must have evidence. You must do more and you must do it better. Cordelia's dilemma reminds us that faith and reverence and respect, this is not about belief, it's about trust. It is a capacity to trust in possibility, by grace and by golly, and in blessings which may be beyond deserving and may be beyond my ability to predict and to control. My subtitle, Vitreous Floaters, what's that about? It's from a fellow Kansas Cityan, Gordon McKenzie. One day, he was aboard a flight waiting to take off, and he writes, tired of reading and having nothing else to do, I got to watching the little hair-like things that float randomly across the surface of my eyeballs. Their erratic behavior reminded me of the amorphous nature of the creative spirit. Perhaps I could use these little visual aberrations to make a point. But first, I needed a quick reality check on these little optical squiggles. And so I turned to the woman in the seat next to me and asked, excuse me, madam, do you by any chance have little hair-like things floating across the surface of your eyeballs? The woman said, what? You too? Do you have those too? I've had those things for years, but I've never wanted to say anything to anybody about them. I was afraid they'd think I'm crazy. Then my seatmate began talking about something she had heretofore considered to be unmentionable. Now she began chatting affably about those lacy phantoms that glide to and fro across our field of vision. Then the man in the window seat on the other side chimed in. Aha! Those are vitreous floaters. It turns out that he was a physician, and he proceeded to give us the scientific view of those little squiggles. And ever since then, my fascination with vitreous floaters as a metaphor for the creative spirit has remained. Have you noticed? If you look right at them, the squiggles, I mean, they go off to the side. And right out of view, they're gone, if you try to keep staring at them. And if you want them to return, all you have to do is stop looking at them. If you do that is stop looking at them, very gradually they just may float back into your line of sight. It's almost as if they're shy. Stare at them, they'll go away. Look the other way, silently they reappear. That's from Gordon Mackenzie. And I wonder, might this have anything to do with human attempts to define or to confine that which is sacred, that which is reverent, and that spirit of reverence? And by the way, if reverence seems like a foreign, unfamiliar notion, ask yourself, when have I ever felt a new perspective emerging in my consciousness? When have I sensed in a time of crisis that my interests are turning around, and that my personality is reorganizing? When have I experienced the horizons of my world stretching out to include new areas of interest? When have I sensed welling up within me a surge of kinship towards someone to which I have heretofore been indifferent? In the aftermath of Tuesday's election, this much I do know, friends. There is a creative possibility that is given to each one of us to be more than the sum of all of the forces that have brought us to this moment. In this moment, I can choose to bless or to curse, to heal or to tear down. In short, to speak goodness and love into being. We began with Saying Grace, a Norman Rockwell painting. There are many ways to embody grace and reverence. Garrison Keillor writes, I went up in the Ferris wheel for a last ride before being thrown into the seventh grade. I went up into the stars and then back to earth, and then I rose again. It was a magnificent vision. I smelled fall in the air, corn dogs, manure, diesel smoke, sawdust. The wheel carries us up high, high. It stops. We sit swaying in the dark. And this is my vision. Little kids holding on to their daddy's hand. He looks down on them with love and he buys them another corn dog. They are worried that they just might lose him. And so they hang on to his leg with one hand and they eat with the other. This vision is unbearably wonderful. And then the wheel brings me down to the ground. We get off and other people get on. Thank you, dear God, for this good life, and forgive us if we do not love it enough.